Good afternoon, and welcome to your own health and fitness. I'm health integration specialist Lena Berman. I'm here live with you on Tuesdays at 2 p.m. talking to you about trends in self-care and about health integration. Today's show is an interview with Lauren Roche, author of Meditation Made Easy. I'll open up the phone lines as usual around 2:40, and the number in and out of the area code is 510-848-4425, and I'll give it out again when we're ready to go. If you miss parts of today's show and want to get a tape cassette copy of it, or if you need more information about the show, you can call my information number 24 hours a day at 707-773-4727, or you can go to the website for the show, delete www, and type in members.aol.com/, and then the initials of the show, YOHAF, Your Own Health and Fitness. Before I introduce my guest, I just want to do a very brief editorial, and it's interesting because the book, as I was reading it, fits very well with something that I was going to say today. I think you'll see as we get into the show. I want to speak to those of you who are thinking of changing your diet for the new year. I'd like to suggest that you think of any dietary change as an experiment, a way to discover more about how you function and what foods work better for you, rather than as a diet plan or something imposed on you from outside, something rigid. Give yourself some time. In general, it takes a couple of months for you to be able to evaluate how something is working for you. Remember that the first 3 weeks you'll be getting over any food addictions or allergic withdrawals that you may have. So you won't really even have a clear sense of how you're feeling at all in 3 weeks, and then really 2 months after that. Either way, what I'm trying to suggest here is that this is an experiment, and the idea is that it may teach you about your individual nutritional needs. And that's worth a lot more than anything that any book or research can tell you about nutrition. It's much less confusing if you use your own body as a laboratory. You know, you can, after several months on a new diet, also have some blood work done and see what effect it's having on your triglycerides and your cholesterol and things like that, so you have a better sense of what's going on. Remember not to freak out if your cholesterol is a little bit higher, but your triglycerides are very low. If your triglycerides are low, you're in good shape. And there's controversy about cholesterol. Certainly you don't want it to be 300 or something. But the other thing is to remember that when you begin some kind of new thing, it's, in my experience, you have better luck if you don't sort of rein yourself in too tight. In other words, if you've made a decision to eliminate certain foods and include new foods, I wouldn't at that point then try to restrict yourself too much about amounts and things like that, because I think what happens is that you start to feel like you're in food jail, and it's very hard to keep it up. The first couple of weeks as you're adjusting to something, I'd be a little more playful with it, just adhering to the basic idea of what you're trying to do. Like if you're eliminating certain foods, then eliminating, but allow yourself to be less conservative with the foods that you like until your body starts to rebalance itself, and then you'll find that you're able to make adjustments according to what you feel or want because of the way you're feeling instead of, again, because of some idea that you have. You'll find that if you begin to find a better balance in your eating, that you'll be able to make changes, like reduce certain things or whatever. In any case, what you're doing, again, is opening up your experience and trying to rebalance yourself and see if your body can instruct you. And that's, I think, what this book is about today. I have a guest with me. His name is Lauren Roche. Are you with us, Lauren?
I'm here.
Oh, good. Let me introduce you. Lauren Roche is author of Meditation Made Easy. He holds a PhD in social science from the University of California at Irvine. He studied anthropology, the sociology of cults, interviewing techniques, and the language of emotion. His doctorate thesis was on the language people generate to talk about their internal experiences in meditation. Lauren Roche has been a meditation trainer for 3 decades. Since 1975, he's developed and taught innovative meditation techniques that are specially tailored to North American lifestyles. He lives in Marina del Rey, California. Do we hear the ocean in the background? Are you outside?
Actually, I just turned on the heater.
Oh, I see. Oh, I hear a whoosh.
Yeah, you can hear the ocean from here, but
yeah, I'm sure you can.
Not yet.
Okay. Am I pronouncing your name correctly?
Yeah.
Roche, it's R-O-C-H-E, again, for people, it's Lauren. Thank you so much for making yourself available. You know, the reason this book was attractive to me, the reason I was attracted to it, and it didn't disappoint me at all, I must say, I really enjoyed the book. It's really fun to read this book. For me, it was. But the reason I was interested in it is because my introduction to meditation was, I very early on, as I explained to you, you asked me, you know, how I started to meditate. I've been meditating for 25 years, and I studied at San Francisco Zen Center's Tassajara, which is a Buddhist monastery, and at that point in its history, it was really very much modeled after the Japanese monasteries. And although I loved monastic life and meditation, I could feel that meditation was making a difference in who I was. I felt like I was sort of giving birth to myself in some way. I kept thinking, especially during intensive meditation periods of 5 days or whatever, where you're in pain and stuff, I kept thinking, I just have a feeling that it's possible to get to some of this without sort of hurting yourself physically or pushing yourself forcing and pushing like that. I kept feeling that there must be some other way to increase your consciousness without doing it in this way. And your book, I think, supports that idea. Why don't you talk a little bit about maybe the potential dangers of learning to push yourself with a meditation practice rather than having it be an opening?
Yeah, well, you know, there's a thing called the busman's holiday. Like if you're a bus driver, and for vacation, you take a tour. You go driving. People push and concentrate all day, so they don't need that in their meditation. If you're a monk, you can push and try during meditation because meditation might be your main activity of the day, and you don't have relationships, you're not in love, you don't have bills to pay, you're not juggling three jobs, a relationship, kids, and car payments. But people concentrate all the time on their jobs, and so they don't need to concentrate during meditation. It would be too much of a good thing. What's needed is to experience what letting go is. And because meditation is there to serve life. It's there to serve your visceral needs. It's there. Meditation should work better than a beer or a glass of wine. And it should be as good as a conversation with your best friend. Because you can be your best friend. You can listen to yourself.
I think that the stated reason for pushing, if that's the right word, when you're doing a formal practice in a monastic situation, is that when you sit with discomfort, and what you discover is that if you move a little bit, it makes it worse, and that if you get stiller, it makes it better. You know, the pain is better if you just soak into it and stop mm-hmm. resisting. And that's a very important lesson because it does help you in your life, because the world presents you with these pop quizzes and difficulties. On the other hand, my own experience was that what it really did was I learned to butch myself around a lot in situations. I learned to push in all situations, uh-huh. and I see that a lot, as you were just saying, you know, when you use the busman holiday. I see that people do that a lot, and that is not a good prescription for the lifestyle that we're leading.
It could be good for some people, though. You know, there in military training, there's a lot of hardship. You have to sit immobile with insects biting you. And
that sounds pretty much like monastic life.
Yeah, and there is a reason for that, and that does satisfy a certain instinct.
What do you think that instinct is? What do you think it is?
Well, it's related to the hunting instinct, mm-hmm. because hunters certainly have to sit still, and your life and the family might be starving. You have to shoot that deer or stick it with your arrow or grab it, depending on what era of hunting we're talking about. And you may have to just sit there, and you're being bitten, and you don't make a sound. And not only do you not make a sound, but you don't mentally protest. Because hunters will tell you that if they think, it scares the animals away.
Well, this may also be true in corporate life, you know, where showing weakness or displaying exactly how you're feeling may not always be opportune. You know, it may not always be the right moment. But
yeah.
But you know, what I think I understood from your book, which is something that I've felt internally for a long time, is that if you have a quality of allowing things to be there, I think most people will attain a stillness within that opening. Like if put somebody in an open field and let them be, there's a way in which I think they will. In other words, I think these two different paths which seem to lead to the same place is what I'm trying to say. And I think
absolutely.
What your book is pointing out is that it's odd, but, you know, actually if you let yourself be who you are and you give yourself room to be who you are without acting it out in a destructive way in the world, if you give yourself this window of opportunity to be who you are, that some of these things that we thought we had to, quote, discipline, unquote, ourselves to do may occur anyway.
Well, you know, people have deep, deep cravings for mental silence. Virtually everybody craves rest, relaxation, and mental silence almost palpably, so much that they barely are able to give into it. And it'll show up as a desire for a vacation or to have an affair or to get away from it all or to be rich. But people crave it. You don't have to make people want to dive into these realms. People crave it. The other thing is that it doesn't take long. When say the average person walks in, about half of the people of a population, if you just invite them to sit down and say, you know, I'll teach you to meditate later, but for now, just tell me what it feels like to breathe. About half of a population will start slipping into meditation in about 30 seconds. And that's the spontaneity of meditation. That's because it is an instinct. Then they have to learn how to handle all the changes. Mm-hmm. But it's a built-in thing. For the problem is to find your individual nature in meditation, mm-hmm. to find your style so that you're not putting yourself to take off on what you said. It's not you're putting yourself in mental jail, but it feels more like an indulgence, or that you're going with a primal instinct that you have. People do put themselves in mental jail in meditation, and that's they have to unlearn that. But, you know, there's meditation that you do under the close personal supervision of some guy. It's usually a guy. That would be one type of meditation. That is things where there's a special setting, there's something monastic or monastic flavored, nouveau monastic, and there's things that you do on your own. Very few people are living with a meditation teacher. And what they do is between them and the student, and it's up to the student to know themselves and know what they need. But that's one realm of things, is when you're actually living in a meditation community. Most people, probably over 99%, are not living in that situation, and they're supervising themselves. So
well,
please, go ahead.
Yeah, all I was going to say is that you demystify meditation in the beginning of the book by saying, you know what, you've had meditation experiences, and then you have a list of things that you describe. And that was, I think, a very important way of giving people entrance into the experience. So do you want to do that? You want to describe a few things that where people may not have realized it, but they've already had a meditation experience?
Yeah, well, if you watch people at the beach, people will look at the horizon and just drift off. And if you talk to them later, if you know the person and they've been at the beach, and say maybe it's a mother with kids, but she gets a few minutes here and there where the kids are right in front of her playing, and she can just drift off looking at the horizon, sort of let her consciousness expand. You'll see an inner peace in her that may last all day or for days. If you know her well, you can actually feel the peacefulness that she's had a little bit of a vacation, even though she was watching the kids. And the only difference really in meditation and just staring at the horizon when you're at the beach is that you come back in again and again. There's a very subtle discipline of letting your thoughts come and then returning to your focus. And that's what people don't do.
I think that's why it's called meditation practice.
Yes.
Is that you are literally learning a tool, which you sometimes say is almost like learning a physical, something physical culture, a form of physical culture, like a sport or
it's
something.
It's like a sport.
Yeah.
The example, what you wanted me to read, I'm looking at the list of when you wake up in the morning. Sometimes we make the transition from sleeping to waking, and there's a time when we're lying there awake, but our body isn't really awake. Our body's asleep, and it's extremely delicious. I mean, we'll usually feel it like, I don't want to get out of bed. I don't want to go anywhere. But it's incredibly sweet, and meditation, many stages of meditation feel that way. We're awake inside, but our body is asleep.
Or resting.
Or resting.
Resting, relaxed. For those of you who are just tuning in, you're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman, and I've got on the phone author of Meditation Made Easy. Incidentally, not to be confused with Meditation Made Simple, because no one is saying it's simple, but it can be easy, and there should be a distinction there. Lauren Roche, R-O-C-H-E, and this is published by Harper in San Francisco.
Another experience is listening to music.
Yes.
And if you
engagement.
Have anybody put on their favorite music and listen to it for 20 minutes or 10 minutes, listen to their favorite music and just give over completely to it. Be ravished by it. Be carried away by it. And then sit for a couple of minutes, say 3 to 5 minutes, feeling the after effect of the music, tracking those sensations in your body, noticing how it changed you.
Now, those are intense states of engagement, which also mm-hmm. sport people who do athletic things do, and people who are in the theater feel a sense of engagement. You know, where you're completely there and you don't have an awareness of what you're doing. You're in the midst of it. It's time stops and you're just in the moment, truly, which I think is enlightenment, frankly. But don't say I said it.
I think there are profound meditative techniques in theater training.
Yeah. But, you know, when I talk to people, I often say to them, they say they're fatigued. I say, can you take 15 minutes, 10 minutes during the day, in the middle of the day, and just stop and sit down and just sit quietly? And people almost get into a panic when you suggest such a thing.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons, there are two reasons that I think it happens. One is because there is a still somewhat puritanical, although it exists in all cultures,
mm-hmm.
attitude that anything good has to be won, you know, that has to be hard, you have to earn it, and that you shouldn't indulge yourself, that you're not supposed to indulge, that if it's too delicious, that's bad.
I agree.
Then the other reason is that some people, when they wake up in the morning in that state, it isn't delicious, their guard is down, and terrible anxiety is there for
yes.
them.
That's true.
So those are the two main things, I think, that prevent people from doing it. And the thing that's interesting about your book is that you encourage this quality of relaxed sensuality in this experience and remind people that this is, you know, you say, like you say, rather than coming home and having a beer, come home and sit for 10 minutes or 15 minutes. And I think that I try to do this with exercise with people too, getting people not to perform something that's good for them because it's a discipline and it's good for them, but getting them to the point where they have a tangible experience of deliciousness.
Yes, and like you were suggesting at the beginning of the show, if you're going to change your diet, see how you feel. Try it as an experiment so that you're using your body. Did you say your body as a laboratory?
Yeah.
I agree. People have good instincts for what they need, at least in meditation.
If they don't interfere with them.
And see, if you're meditating and you're like in a Zen community, that's one thing. You're in a system where there's an external authority. If you're meditating on your own, I found that people are actually safer meditating on their own, following their own instincts. People have really good instincts for knowing how much to meditate, what kind of meditation to do.
Very much so.
And yeah.
And well, that isn't to say, just to keep this, like we were saying, easy instead of simplistic, that isn't to say that, for instance, when you make a change, and you point this out in the book, that when you make a change, even if it's a change that is more inclusive and it feels good to you, there may be a period getting through a sort of curtain that you have to walk through where you feel anxiety and pain or discomfort because the body is rebalancing. Sometimes you've been in such a state of turmoil that, and you talk about this in the book, that when you first start to sit, or if you're changing your diet, you go through a transition period, and the transitional period isn't always comfortable.
No. Well, you know...
So you have to be patient, too, I think.
When people sit down to meditate, they often feel pain. But people know what good pain is. That one of the reasons why I'm such a bear about making meditation feel like an indulgence is because when it's informal, when people take an informal approach, it means that the instincts have a stronger voice. Now, what do I mean? If you say, "Honey, would you rub my legs? I'm a mailman, and I was walking all day, and my knees kind of sore, and my shoulders hurt." So you come home and you say to your lover, "You know, honey, just rub." It hurts. They'll say, "You know, my shoulders are tense or my legs hurt." It hurts when they rub you. Or if you see athletes rubbing their legs, it hurts to put your hands on sore tissue. But you know, and animals know, you can do this with animals. Animals will let you pull a thorn out of their paw. You know what's good pain. You know this. The body knows it. And there's a sweet kind of pain of fatigue. When people sit down when they're tired, it's a little bit painful to feel the fatigue, but it's one of the great pleasures of life.
Well, I think it is for people who have, let's see, how can I say this? I think that there's something about transitions here, and I think that transitions are particularly anxiety-producing for people. So, for instance, using the metaphor of a dietary change, when you change someone's diet, as I said during the editorial, for the first 2 weeks, they may experience terrible withdrawal symptoms. In the same way, if you sit down in meditation for the first time and you've not done it before, what I've found is that people may feel angry at the people sitting around them if they're sitting with a group, or furious about the noise outside, or irritated and anxious and restless, and think this is the wrong thing to do.
Yes.
So there's something about knowing that a transitional period is going to cause some discomfort, and that
you're right, and that's a pretty good map of what everybody of the thoughts that everybody thinks. What you did those three.
Well, I've been there, done that. You know.
Yeah, that's a pretty good map, and so it really does help to just say in advance, "I welcome all of these thoughts, including the thoughts, you're doing it wrong,
right.
No, I shouldn't be there, these people stink," or whatever.
Yeah, I hate the people outside with the
yeah.
leaf blower. Well, and, you know, then we go back to this thing which certainly the tradition that I studied in Zen Buddhism, particularly the style that I studied, stressed not putting anyone's head over your own. And yet, you know, you're instructed to do this a certain way, and the whole time I'm like, on the one hand, trying to adhere to a certain map that they've given me, although the map is looser than some of the other meditation practices, a little less baroque, and at the same time I'm reading things about how if you meet the Buddha on the road, kill the Buddha, because it's your experience that's your map. So people very easily give up their own sense of their own experience. It's very easy, even if someone is saying don't do it, they still have, I think people still feel very insecure about following.
Yes.
You use a wonderful metaphor of saying that we're hunter-gatherers, and that this process that we go through, even if we're doing it while we're meditating, if you're sitting there and sorting, even that, and I found that profound to read that in the book, to say, if you sit down on your cushion and you're just sitting there the whole time sorting, that may be what you need to do, that you have to trust your innate sense of how to live and how to survive according to your needs, and not squelch that. That's so sorting out what you need in meditation, or what you need in your life, or what you need, or even if you're, you know, buzzing when you're sitting for a while, that's okay.
That's right, and it's a form of self-care. There's a lot of instincts that come into play during meditation. Also grooming. You know, in a way, meditation is a human homing instinct.
Yes, I agree.
And yet it feels also, there's times when it feels like we're following a faint trail, you know, following the breath or following an impulse, you can meditate on the sense of wonder. You can meditate with listening to the sounds of nature or listening to the silence. It does feel like hunting, and there's times when it feels like grooming, like That's why I use the metaphor of massage. Breath often feels like an extremely subtle massage flowing through the body, sort of soothing all of the frazzled nerve circuits. That's instinctively speaking, that's grooming behavior.
I like the metaphor of home coming, returning home.
Yes, and orienting.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned balancing earlier.
Very much.
That it feels like balancing. And women in particular talk about meditation as balancing. They can actually feel, because women, almost all the women I know are like the Hindu goddesses with like eight arms, and they're juggling many different facets of life, the relationships and work, and meditation is a time to find balance in the midst of it. It's like the juggler sort of sharpening his balance, doing some exercises to sharpen his balance.
We're going to stop and take a 30-second break in a second. When we come back, what I want to talk about is enlightenment and also this issue of nothingness, which is very hard for people, whether there's a nothingness. So this is Lena Berman. I'm on the phone with Lauren Roche, R-O-C-H-E, author of Meditation Made Easy, published by Harper. We're going to take a brief 30-second musical break, and then when we come back, we'll continue our discussion about meditation. Stand by. Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integration specialist Lena Berman on the phone with Lauren Roche, author of Meditation Made Easy, a paperback book published by Harper, which I think I can say that I honestly recommend. I enjoyed the book a lot. I think it's a good book. We're talking about making meditation accessible and the fact that it's an experience that all of us have in our lives. You know, this thing of stop and smell the rose when you lean over and smell a flower and you suddenly stop and really smell it for a second, that there's a way in which that's a state of engagement, that's a state of meditation. Many of the Eastern religions that have come through and have been an inspiration for people to study meditation stress meditation as a tool that, because it helps to slow you down, encourages a quality of non-dualism, not this or that, but just being where you are, and non-judgmental acceptance of states. You know, in Zen they say moon-face Buddha, sun-face Buddha, same thing. Somehow or another, support for this gets lost, and you talk in your book about using a term that's been bandied around a lot, is that the shadow gets, you don't have, that's not, you can be, there's all this goodness, but not badness. Just goodness. So any of the dark stuff or the stuff that hasn't been given a voice starts to come up and people kind of go, eek.
Well, yeah, and of course, in spiritual communities, because they don't talk about it, it bites them even more. I mean, if you talk to a lot of people who've been in ashrams, they describe them as the most vicious political organizations they've ever been in.
Yeah.
And I just have a feeling that we haven't earned the right to use in America to use the word enlightenment.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
It's a toxic notion. It's distancing.
Well, you know what I find interesting about it, since you brought it up, the word enlightenment, is that, and I don't know if this is something that I've experienced more with men than women, but it certainly has come up for me in conversations with men more than women, is that they are practicing meditation in the hopes of becoming enlightened, and this being a state where your filters really drop away, you know, although it's presumptuous to talk about it, as you say, but having this sense of the truth, you know. And I, you know, honestly didn't think that what I read, when I read that the Buddha said that enlightenment and our daily lives are the same, I didn't think that that was a joke. I thought that my sense was that you cultivate this state of relaxed awareness because that is enlightenment, and it comes and goes. You go in and out of a state of grace. And one of the things about having a meditation practice is that it facilitates that easy relaxed way of being in the world in other things that you do, in everything that you do when you practice meditation.
And that's enough. I mean, that's
I think it is. I think it's pretty good.
I mean, it's really, there's times when, I mean, there are layers of relaxation that are so fabulous that feels like clairvoyance and I'm living in a transcendental dimension. But I think cats know this. When they walk out of the door in their little patrols. I think animals know this. I mean, when a human being is really relaxed, I'm sure angels can sing about that because so few of us manage to do it. But it's stunning to walk out the door, walk down the street with absolutely no fear in your body. It's amazing what
happens.
Well,
I can't promise that I'm able to do that often. Sometimes
me
I can, sometimes
I mean,
I can.
It happens sometimes. And
okay.
It's like drink. It's like, what have I been drinking? It's a sense of universal love. But people, mothers know this, pregnant women, this happens to. I went over to visit my sister the other day, and she was radiant. My sister works part-time, goes to school full-time, and has two babies. And she was just glowing, and I said, what have you been doing? And finally, it turned out the baby woke her up at 3 in the morning, and she sat at 3 in the morning nursing the baby. Mm. And she really felt the entire neighborhood. The windows were open. It was warm. She could hear all around, and she knew, she could feel no one was awake. And she was just with the goddess. She was in the mystery of nursing. She felt life flowing into her and life flowing out through her breast. Into her baby, she was in love. She had a moment to herself, and she was lit up from that. Even the next day.
Yeah, and I think that part of what you're saying with this book is that people needn't make this into a job. Meditation. That if you allow yourself to have some of this delicious time on a regular basis in your life, if you make room for it, even if you start, you have little practices and things people can try and little short things, that even that it sort of grows, it sort of snowballs.
Yeah, and it's good actually to learn meditation 1 or 2 minutes at a time because you build good skills that way.
Yeah, and you talk about the fact that the brain learns as it's doing this too, but you know, the other side of this is that people can use, we've seen people use anything as a drug. And I've had people complain to me that they think that, and of course I think if it's a drug and it's a good drug, I don't mean literally pharmaceuticals and drugs. I mean that if meditation is working in a way that feels euphoric to you, that's not a bad thing. But the point is that people are afraid of the sense of nothing, that there's going to be nothing.
Well, there is. It's a strange thing, but that when you're relaxed, you can experience this when you get a massage or after lovemaking. Say you're floating there in the space after lovemaking. The body feels like neon. There's like a faint sense of, say, neon. But you often, it feels like empty space when the body is relaxed, maybe with like the night sky. There's a lot of states of relaxation where actually it does feel like nothing, and especially when thoughts aren't there, when there's no thoughts, the inside of your head can feel absolutely empty.
Well, people aren't
far from this. A lot of times in group meditations, I'll have people meditate for 1 minute and then say what they're, and then maybe turn to their neighbor and just say 3 words, and then meditate for 2 minutes. And then open the eyes and turn to their neighbor and say a couple of words. And a lot of people, within seconds, feel nothingness. It's right there, and they're actually afraid of it.
Well, they're not only afraid of it, but as I said before, in that space, sometimes anxiety or feelings will come up that people haven't been allowing in their everyday lives. And you mentioned in the book that sometimes doing some therapy of whatever sort works for you is important. In other words, having the fullness of who you are and not rejecting parts of yourself that you feel unqualified to handle alone may arise. And if they do, you need to get some help. Or you don't have to, but it certainly is another way of supporting and caring for yourself to get somebody to help you with that so that you become more comfortable with that part of yourself.
Yeah, I think probably all meditators need therapy.
I agree with that.
At some point or another, that might not be it for 10 years, but at some point they might need therapy, and maybe just short-term therapy, maybe just a month, maybe 10 sessions. One of the things that happens to me over and over again, when I'm just being with myself in meditation, is that I remember every therapy session I've ever had. I've had a lot of talk therapy and a lot of Rolf thing. I got Rolf starting in the late 60s at Esalen and did a lot of really good body work. And for somehow, my body savors the memory of every session I've ever had, and it helps me to be with whatever's going on with me during meditation.
Mm-hmm.
Other people can give us the gift of their attention, their skill at attention. And then when we're meditating, we internalize it, and we learn to be with our own process as skillfully as those gifted people were being with us during the session.
You talk about that compassion for yourself is in a way, this is a quote from you, when you realize that even your critical voices are trying to care for you and may need to be heard. You also say, and this is a quote from the book, whatever you leave out can't be integrated. So that's sort of what you've been talking about. When do the critical voices win? And I'm thinking here of odious rules.
The odious rules, well, they win, yeah, if we become owned by them. Listening, see, it's a strange paradox. The more you listen to negative voices, the more disempowered they are. And in fairy tales, when you do battle with something, you absorb its power into your body. And the critical voices, just by listening to them, you absorb their energy. But if you let them become your meditation teacher, which they love to do, then you lose. They do. People will actually read meditation books and the different how-to books until they find the rules that match their negative inner voices, and then that's their set of techniques. Is that clear?
Oh, yeah. No, it's very clear. It's very obvious, too. It's embarrassing to think about, isn't it? We all think about what we did when we were young. Odious rules. You talk about making fun of them. There's another concept that you seem to be talking about in the book, which, and I will open the phone lines shortly, but that I also heard Norm Fisher over at San Francisco Green Gulch Farm once say, which is that he had this amazing thing come to him once that you know, this whole idea of not giving into desire, that if you in fact allow yourself to feel desire and have the fullness of the desire, that you satisfy the desire without acting on it. That you
sometimes,
can,
yeah.
By letting yourself have the fullness of what you're feeling, there's a satiation, a satisfaction from that.
There is. Sometimes just savoring the desire electrifies your body and gives you a feeling of romance about life. Like, I love red wine. I mean, for me, red wine is like the blood of creation. I can't drink it because I'm sort of allergic to the chemical.
Yep.
It just makes me tired, and sometimes it'll make me sneeze. And so I don't drink red wine, but a lot of times, after meditating, I'll drink a glass of water, and I'll just remember how much I love red wine.
There you go.
And my whole body rejoices.
Mm-hmm.
In it.
Lastly, before I open up the phone lines, I would like you to talk about relying on the rebel in you.
Oh, okay. Right now?
Yeah, and then we'll open up the phone lines.
Well, you know, the feeling I don't want to meditate it's often the true voice of the guidance, the person's internal guidance system. It's the rebel in people, especially people who are interested in spirituality and self-help. The rebel is the part that looks out for you and wants to protect you against being grabbed by some conformist system. It stands up for your individuality because you can't possibly be a perfect fit for a one-size-fits-all system. You're going to be different than the teacher or the people that school was developed for. And the rebel in you looks out for your individuality.
Yeah, it's often the most, so the things that we think of, the most negative things that we think of about ourselves, the parts of ourselves that we think are bad, that are the most true in terms of what works better for us.
Yeah.
Driving us to, you know, giving us a sense of what's better. You know, like, not being a team player. You know, actually, those people are the people who work best alone and really do well working alone. So that kind of stuff, you know.
Yes, and that's what, you know, in constructing our meditation practice, we want to always welcome the rebel.
Yeah, I'll say. Let me just give the number out for people who want to join us. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. We're talking with meditation instructor and author of Meditation Made Easy, Lauren Roche, R-O-C-H-E. I'm Lena Berman. We've opened up the phone lines at 510-848-4425 in whatever area code you're in, 510-848-4425. We do have phone lines available if you want to get in and ask some questions about meditation practices. I think we have a first caller. It's Russell in Sebastopol.
Hello.
Yeah, Russell, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. It's a very interesting show. I'm a relatively beginning meditator for about a year, and I'd like Lauren to explain the difference, if there is one, between trance and meditational states, how they interrelate or do not, especially in the non-dual tradition. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Russell.
Thank you.
Interesting question.
Yeah, well, trance is broadly defined. There's many different definitions. There's an anthropological sense of trance in the magical and religious practices of shamans the world over and throughout time. And although there's a broad overlap between trance and meditation, I think it's better to consider them separate but very similar realms. The difference between trance and meditation can be the method of induction. Like in trance, for example, there's rattle, the shamanistic drum, the rattles, the repetitive chanting. And in meditation, there's also rhythm. You know, there's a rhythmic pulsing of breath and heartbeat.
We've got a lot of callers waiting to jump on, so if I could get you to kind of...
Oh, okay. Make it, cut it short.
Just a little.
It's more of a different purpose. Both are utilizing this immense ability the human nervous system has for perceiving things. But they go in slightly different directions.
Okay. Let's move on to Ed in Berkeley.
Hi. A good program. What about those times in meditation where that I get into anyway, where I'm neutral in a wrong, in a bad sense? It's like if I meditate, I don't get into, you know, have a struggle. I don't get anything out of it particularly. I'm totally neutral about it, and I often find that those are the times that I sort of drift away from it. I think of myself as a meditator, but when I turn around and I say, oh, well, I haven't meditated very lately, and it's because the last five times nothing's happened. And I know, you know, what I've done in the past is done that macho thing you were talking about, this sort of butch it through kind of thing, and I know that's the wrong way.
How long do you meditate for?
Oh, I like to meditate, so sometimes 2 hours, sometimes 10 minutes.
I would think experiment with meditating for 15 to 20 minutes instead of doing it once a day.
Mm-hmm.
Meditate when you get up in the morning, take a shower, meditate, and then go do your day, and then meditate before dinner. But meditate for shorter. You can meditate for 20 minutes to 30 minutes if you want.
Mm-hmm.
But don't go by how you feel. Actually, set a clock.
Oh, boy, that's very difficult for me to do anything kind of regular. I would definitely feel like I was doing the hard thing on that one.
Yeah, then, because what you want to do is orient meditation to benefit your life.
Okay.
Where you can tell the meditation's working because you feel you feel better doing your activities.
Great, thank you.
Check
that out, Ed.
Okay, yeah.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Catherine in Danville.
Yeah, hi.
Hi, Catherine.
I've been trying to meditate for, gosh, tens of years, and it just never seems to make any sense. I guess I was born with artistic talents, which, when I practice them, probably gives me the most peace I've ever...
What kind of art? Painting or drawing?
Painting, actually. And I'm also the mother of three kids, one of which is autistic, and she's actually become in the 3% realm of almost normal, like just, you know, so it's taken an incredible amount of work.
Yeah.
So I've been, I'm truly think it's a miracle in that respect, but there's been a huge need in my life to be more peaceful and just, you know, calmer with all the phenomena that goes along with child rearing and then normalizing an autistic child. Aside from that, I was always looking for meditation, but it just never...
Well, for you, meditating, getting 1 minute to meditate in 3 minutes is a big triumph. And one approach for you would be to draw a circle and then color it in with any favorite color, whatever strikes you, a vivid purple or chartreuse or a green. Look at that and breathe that color for 30 seconds to 1 minute. And then close the eyes and continue breathing for another minute. But meditate 1 minute here, 5 minutes there, as you can fit it in, and see if you can get several of those in a day, and then build on that.
That's a good suggestion.
Welcome all of the intense passion that you feel, because you're a woman of, you have intense drive, you've worked really hard with your child, and there's a lot of vivid experience inside yourself. Welcome all of that.
Yeah, people often think they have to give up their the speed of their life or their intensity with meditation. You
they
don't
do.
Have
they
to
think,
do that.
And you don't have to slow down or turn down the volume inside.
Yeah, you just have to experience it. Or you don't have to, but it's
you
interesting.
Can.
It's interesting.
You may as well.
Yeah. Michael in Sunnyvale.
I'll just turn the radio down here for a second. Is that better? Thanks for the show. I appreciate that. Dr. Roshi, well, there's two things I want to touch on. The first thing was near the end of your talk, right around 20 to 3, you were talking about something, and you asked, do you know what I mean? And Lena said, yes, I do, and I didn't follow it. Can you remember what that was?
No, Michael. Lena, do you remember?
No, I don't. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay.
Any hints, Michael?
Well, I was...
20 questions.
I was just sort of getting...
It's pretty obscure. Anyway, do you have a question, Michael?
The other thing I wanted to say just to that last caller, the woman who does some artistic pursuits, is that, and she hasn't done much meditation, is that if you can get used to it, from my experience, you do get a little more alpha brainwave state in your mind when you're used to meditating.
Well, that's a whole different topic, Michael. What's your question?
Well, no, that's it. I was just saying it does help your intuitiveness, though.
Okay.
And that's all. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Michael.
It does help your intuitiveness.
We do have some lines open if anyone wants to join us. It's 510-848-4425. Again, 510-848-4425. There's a real taboo on caring for ourselves. I'm really always impressed with how much fear people have around caring for themselves. Like people are really impressed with how little they can sleep and stuff like that. It's very odd to me because, I think, you know what I think happens is, from the standpoint of Chinese medicine, when people's energy gets depleted, their lower body energy gets depleted, the energy shoots up out of the top of their head, is the way they describe it,
mm-hmm.
and then you get this buzzy, speedy kind of thing, like should. We do have a couple callers now.
And that is kind of a description mm-hmm. of what it is to be an American.
Yeah. We have Susan in Oakland on the line.
Hi.
Hi, Susan.
Sometimes when I meditate, more and more images will come, like symbolic images.
Mm-hmm.
And is that actually qualify as meditation? Can I, it's been hard recently to completely quiet my mind.
Well, forget about quieting your mind. Welcome all the impulses.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that the relative quiet comes and goes. It pulses. You'll feel a movement of settling down, and then you'll feel a movement of activation. And these two movements, one is settling down towards greater restfulness, and the other is movement towards activation. These tend to cycle every 30 seconds. And sometimes it gets to be a longer rhythm, maybe several minutes of quieting down and then several minutes of activation. But those are the two great movements of the nervous system, in towards the self and towards resting and recharging, and out towards the world. And even when our meditation is mostly focused out towards the world, like, oh, tomorrow I give a big speech, or I have to ask for a raise, or I'm in the Olympics, or I'm in the dance contest, even when there's a situation like that and our meditation is mostly mental rehearsing, it's still very good and very powerful. And train yourself to accept both of those phases. See, athletes, before their races or before their events, will sit down or lie down and mentally go through their whole performance, whether it's something in the Olympics or a race. And they're practicing doing their event while relaxed, and the body streamlines its moves. So that's what happens spontaneously to anybody when they meditate. So accept all of that mental activity. It's your life happening.
I think that's one of the most valuable things in your book, Lauren, is that you encourage people not to edit what happens in meditation, and I think that that's a very important message for people.
Yeah, the images are not of... Yeah, thank you. That's a really good answer. The images are not of things, physical things or real things. They're very symbolic and...
abstract shapes?
Some are, but some are very vivid of real things, but that I've never seen before, or just really some.
What do you mean symbols? Have you looked them up in books of symbols or what?
No, I haven't. But I sometimes have used those to answer some questions for myself or to understand myself.
It feels a little bit like a dream state. Are you disturbed by the fact that you're having images?
No, I'm not. Okay. I just realized that where in my life before, where I would get those images, it would relax me and get me into the meditation.
Yeah.
Now it excites me because they're so fascinating, and they're it's like watching my subconscious mind go by like a film.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, that's one of the challenges for meditation, is learning to be easy with ourselves even though we're awake in states of rest deeper than sleep. And we all have these experiences continuously at night, but we're asleep. During meditation, you're resting and you're watching the brain working, but you're awake. So enjoy it. And if you want, draw it. Draw some of the symbols.
Let's see if we can get Patricia in Marin on. We have to make it quick now, Patricia. We've only got about 30 seconds to a minute.
Hi, Patricia.
Hi. Thank you so much for having the show. As I was trying to hone down my question, I mainly just really want you to know how much I appreciate it, and it sounds like others are calling in. And if you guys could get together again or make this even a regular...
Well, I'd love to.
Fabulous. My main thing out of years and years of... and I'm getting the book. There's no doubt about that. Thank you. I have had a lot of injuries, and so I have a lot of distortions. I haven't really, followed Lena's instructions and worked out. So my resistance to meditation is, the way it starts feeling too soon.
I'm sorry to do this, but I've got to get you to kind of hone it down,
because
we've only got a second here.
That's it.
So what's your question?
You know, working, maybe I'll find it in the book, of how to work around
the injuries,
engaging in meditation when all that sense of pain comes up.
I think for you, music, prayer, and chanting, you want to make the meditation, you want to set the charge high before you meditate so that you're not just having to track bodily sensations of pain. And if you have any prayers that you like to do, I would do those, or chant even, so that you get a higher frequency of vibration in your body.
And you don't have to sit cross-legged on the floor, too.
You might want to lie down
with a pillow under your knees or something. Well, we've got to stop, reluctantly.
Too bad.
Yeah,
time is flown.
You're big fun, and your book is really very, very nice. It's very comforting and fun to read. So, Meditation Made Easy, Lauren Roche. You have a little website, don't you?
Yes, but it's not quite up yet.
LaurenRoche.com,
and I have to... Okay. Figure out how to put it up.
Well, I hope you put it up soon, because I did put it on my website, so people are going to try to reach it, and they'll probably call me and complain.
Well, they'll do it tonight, then.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you so much for the show.
Okay.
Thanks all of you who called in and participated. If you missed part of the show and you want to get a tape of today's show, or if you need information, you can call my information number at 707-773-4727, 773-4727 in the 707. Or you can go to the website, delete www, and type in members.aol.com/YOHAF. For a list of other available shows on paper, send a self-addressed stamped business-sized envelope with two stamps to P.O. Box 2714, Petaluma, California, 94953. Thanks to Jim Bennett for boarding today. Next week, I'll be with nutritionist Claire Felix, author of The Felix Letter. We'll be reviewing the best nutrition news from 1998. I'm Lena Berman. This has been your own health and fitness talk show on KPFA and KPFK-FM. See you next week.